Hi, this is Alan Clark of the Hollies, and you're listening to Pantheon Podcast.
Pantheon Podcasts presents from Hollywood, California, The Devil's Music with Pleasant Gaiman. You are invited to join the Hollywood princess as she explores her lifelong pursuits in the occult, sex, love, and that sinful rock and roll. Ladies and gentlemen, step into the dark parlor of Pleasant Gaiman as she brings you The Devil's Music.
Hi, I'm Pleasant Gaiman, and welcome to The Devil's Music, a Pantheon podcast. As the devil himself apparently once said via the Rolling Stones, please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a rock and roll witch from Hollywood, California. My obsession with music and the occult started at the age of 12 and is still going strong. During the 70s, I was one of the first punks in Los Angeles. I worked at the Whiskey A Go-Go and had a Xerox fanzine called Lobotomy, which led me to writing a rock and roll gossip column in the LA Weekly, which in turn led me to writing for every major rock publication you could think of. In the 80s through the 90s, I fronted three bands. I'm a best-selling author with 8 books out and more on the way. For the past 30 years, I've been a professional dancer who's toured around the globe teaching and performing, and you've probably seen me dancing in a number of music videos, feature films, and documentaries. I'm also an actor with several film credits. Find out more about me at PleasantGaiman.com. I'm really excited to be a part of the Pantheon Podcast Network of rock and roll shows. Everyone at Pantheon tells spectacular stories about the music we love so much, each one with a different twist. Find them all at PantheonPodcast.com, as well as on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, radio.com, Pandora, hell, I just had to say that, anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts. If you like what we're doing here, head on over to pantheonpodcast.com and share a show with a friend, or I'll put a spell on you. Kidding. This is Pleasant Gaiman, and welcome to the Devil's Music Podcast. Today's guest is so illustrious and so fantastic and such an old friend of mine that this episode is probably going to make almost any other one I've recorded pale in comparison. Today, I'm going to be talking to Kid Congo Powers, who, as you guys know, was in the Cramps, the Gun Club, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and currently has his own band for ages, and they have a new record out called Kid Congo and the Pink Monkey Birds. So you'll hear all about the record in this and all about horrifying stuff that we have done together that we probably would both still be incarcerated for if there was social media. Please welcome Kid Congo.
Hey, Flez, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm not in jail.
Me neither.
for past indiscretions. No, it's great to talk to you, Flez. I mean, when before your intro, we were already laughing. Then I was just thinking to myself, we have just been laughing since the moment we met. We haven't stopped.
I know. I know, it's been like, it's seriously been like Salvador and Gala Dali with me and you.
100%.
It's been like a 45-year exercise in surrealism, and I'm happy for that.
Oh, but, so great. I mean, we pick up right where we left off always.
No, I know. I love that. The last time I saw you in LA when you guys were playing at the Echo, some people lately, this is going to sound so modern, I'm saying that in huge air quotes, some people were saying that they were just like on the other side of the dressing room, like watching us talk. And they're like, you guys have the best chemistry together. Do you think we should get married? Oh, no, wait, you're already married. Yes. But if you ever move to Utah, or if either one of us ever consider a compound in Utah, I'll be your first wife.
That would be very big of me. To do yes, and it's great. It was great to see you. God, I can't even believe. I mean, yeah, I'm gonna get. I don't mean to do shameless self promotion, but I just finished writing a memoir, and you feature so much in it that, you know, and I've always realized and cherished our friendship and know how much, but when I was writing about it, and more when I was reading back about it, I'm like, oh my God, we were so connected and so dedicated to 24/7 hilarity and insanity, you know? And love of music and love of just, chaotic, you know, a taste for the grotesque and also and just the askew looking at life. It's just so great.
I know we could always just like look at each other from across the room when something was happening that didn't even involve us and start laughing. But for those of you guys that are listening to this, Kid and I we've been roommates at like a ton of different places in LA and in New York. Like,
yes.
So we lived at, before we start going into horror stories, which there's going to be so many, first tell everyone about your new record. And I still call it records, but.
Yes, it's a record. I call it a record too. It's not a vinyl, it's a record. It's an EP, which means it's a small LP or a big 12-inch single. And it is called Swing from the Chandelier. And it's actually a tribute to the person, Chandelier, the LA
Luminary.
Yes, our dear friend. And the lead song is called Chandelier, but it's spelled Chandelier. And it's actually it's a friend of ours, a non-binary rock and roll mainstay, also hilarious, in the LA music scene, who was just ubiquitous everywhere you went. There was Chandelier. And you know, in amazing outfits and so funny and great and so dedicated to loving music at the highest level and the arts. So anyway, he passed away of cancer a couple of years, 2018. And I immediately just thought, I have to write something. And I just was like, I have to somehow capture the essence of Chandelier, you know, like before it goes away, you know, because so right away, I just wrote down all these different images and, you know, and I was thinking of like, where is he now? I said, oh, he's swinging from the chandelier, of course. That's where he is, you know, above the fray, beyond the pale, you know, that's where he is. And so I wrote the song in kind of in tribute to him. And so we ended up making that the lead song of the record, and that will be a video, and, you know, and so yeah, so it's a tribute, you know, to my LA and to Chandelier and my people, our tribe, you know, which we cherish so much. It's a great tribe.
Chandelier was so amazing. You guys out there in podcast land, if you want to listen to some of Shandy's music, he had a band called Glue that was super huge, popular in LA in like the late 90s and the early 2000s. But he's also He really is an international figure. He was living in Vienna. He was always in New York. He was, Shandy was total jet set fabulosity. I'm like Greyhound bus fabulosity, like me and kid were for a long time. let's take a little break to hear some music, and then we will come right back and start telling horror stories.
Life is short, filled with stuff, don't know what for, I ain't had enough.
Okay, here we are back. All right, what? How do we even start with? Do you remember the first time that we met each other?
Well,
I remember seeing you all the time before we met, but I don't know if I remember the exact moment.
I do, and I think it was when the Screamers. The Screamers. You're going to have to do the narration of what we're talking about. But the band The Screamers, an LA phenomenon in the 1978, 77, 78, 70, I don't know, maybe 76 even.
Yeah.
The dates are, you know, blurry to me. But I think they used to have these great parties, and they were, and Tomata was from, DiPlenty, the singer, was from New York, and he, you know, was at the beginning of the, he was in a, you know, like theater, he did Theater of the Ridiculous and was doing stuff with Fayette Hauser from Coquettes and Gorilla Rose, and they lived in New York, and they were actually doing their play skits at CBGB, and they were there, like they were there when the Ramones came in to do their audition for
CBGB. I know. And Blondie too, huh?
And Blondie as well. So yeah, so Chris Stein and Deborah Harry knew them from way back, the earliest of CBGB. And so they were having a party for Blondie and at their house.
Did we just only meet each other? Did we only just meet each other then? Because I thought we knew each other before that party.
I don't know, but the way I remember it.
That's good. But that party was fucking insane. Everyone was so high at that party. I mean, this party, you guys, I can't even tell you how legendary. Actually, KK, the old drummer of the Screamers, sent me a couple of pictures of it. He has a bunch of pictures with spaghetti all over the floor from when Black Randy and the Metro Squad, like he just took this like huge, like cafeteria sized pot of spaghetti and dumped it over his own head. And then he was like, he was running down the steps of the Wilton Hilton, which was the Screamers house. It was this old craftsman house that was haunted. And so what else? I remember Debbie was so fucking high on pot in the backyard, smoking pot with like Joey Ramone and like Helen Keller and all these people. And she kind of like, I was on acid, I think, but she stumbled backwards a few steps and I said, "What are you doing?" And she tried to cover up for it by going, "Oh, I was just smelling that tree." And even though I was tripping, I was like, "Wow, she's higher than I am."
It was hilarious. But I remember that I knew we had seen each other around and been around everywhere. And I remember I was a bit of a sullen youngster, very lonery. But I was really Randy K. You were already doing Lobotomy by then, and yeah. Randy K. You know, said, "I remember you from going to Rodney Bingenheimer's, from Rodney's," and then I was like, "Oh," and then he was always with you, and I thought, gosh, she is great. And I overheard you were talking about Eve Babbitt's, reading Eve Babbitt's.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. And I knew about Eve Babbitt's, and I was like, wow, she is great. And you know, how can I be a part of what she's about? And then you just came up to me and said, oh, you're that Ramones fan club guy, aren't you? And I said, yes. And then you said something like, well, you need to write for my fanzine, Lobotomy. And I was like, okay. And then it was on. Oh my God.
Okay, so I remember my favorite story that you wrote for Lobotomy was that I think this was when we were already living together at 909 Palm, which was the first Lobotomy apartment. But we'll talk about 909 and Disgraceland and the other places we lived at in a minute. But the Village People played at the Greek Theater. And this was like in like 1977 or eight. I think it was maybe 1978. But you wrote a review for, because we used to review like, in that we'd review like the new 999 or Sex Pistols or Damn single, but then we'd also review like the free giveaway records from Jack in the Box or just any horrifying old like 45s we found. So the review you did, you said you had to go to the Village People and you wrote the Village People Go Greek, because that's what it was called.
I had t-shirts that said that. It was amazing. And I couldn't get one. I went by myself. I couldn't get one friend to go. And I was like, I'm going. I don't care. You know, it's going to be great. And it was great. Yeah. And they had t-shirts that said, people go Greek. And there was all these mothers buying it for their children and stuff.
Yeah, people had kids there.
It was so subversive.
That's so, oh, I know, that's so fucking amazing. Let's talk about 909 and then the little trip that we took up to San Francisco together. Do you remember that?
Oh God, yeah.
Okay, so first of all, 909 was this sort of 1950s apartment house that we had an apartment in there, and we were the noisiest people in the building, go figure. It was Kid and Dennis Crosby, who was, God rest his soul, he was Bing Crosby's grandson. And I met him in high school because he was like roller skating through the halls and doing amyl nitrate when I was cutting a class. That was how we met. Became best friends. He was one of our roommates. And then so was Anne McLean, who was this amazing, beautiful girl that was like a Rodney's English Disco regular and just like joined in the punk scene. So we were all living at 909, and somehow, I don't even remember how, but this is, whenever I think of this, I always think of 909. Somebody had found this like suede patchwork, like 1960s. maxi skirt that had like mushrooms on it and like
snail.
A snail and mushrooms.
Crawling amongst the mushrooms.
And we'd be in the middle of like fucking like listening to like the new Clash's record, and everyone was like drinking, and there'd be like stiff baiters there, and half the people from like the fucking whiskey. Dennis used to go on the PA at the whiskey and give everyone our address and just invite everybody. And then Ed would always like, he'd disappear for a minute and you'd come back in this like sleeveless quilted padded like like Chinese vest and the maxi skirt with a snail on it, and you'd put your hands together in a praying position and say, does anybody want some herbal tea?
Oh my God, what a characters. But that we were going to take the joke as far as we could take it.
Remember when I handcuffed that there was some busboy that Dennis invited to a party, because he also used to invite random people. And so this was a busboy from a restaurant in West Hollywood, and he could barely speak English, but he was handsome. So when this guy like came to 909, there was men running around in drag. You were probably in the maxi skirt. There was women in underwear, and there was craziness. So I think that the guy thought that he had walked into a brothel, and he was starting to get sort of handsy with like, you know, some of the girls like Carrie Chrome and Lisa C. Vaughn. So our dining room table was held together with my handcuffs, and I took my handcuffs off and I was like dangling them and motioning him for him to go out on the balcony. And I said, look, I can put them on myself. And I demonstrated. I said, can I put them on you? And he immediately held his hands up. And then I handcuffed him to the balcony railing and I closed the sliding door. But we forgot about him until like 11 the next morning. Dennis said, whatever happened to that guy? And I was like, oh, that guy. And he was like a prisoner. He had his arm up, handcuffed to the railing, and he was like in fetal position. I still feel so bad about that.
He had a good time. And was that the guy who was named Elvis Hitler?
that was from... that was from a bowling alley. Remember, that was on his driver's license?
Yes, exactly. I know. It was amazing. So what happened? We made friends with someone else. And what did they say? Their name was Elvis or something? We said, no, come on.
Yeah.
And didn't he show you? Yeah, and he showed us his driver's license, and the name was Elvis Hitler.
Wait, did we? But that was his real name, and I'm saying this with huge air quotes. He was an old man, which might mean he was like barely 30 or something.
Exactly. Yeah.
Did we meet him at the Olympic Auditorium or at a bowling alley? I think
that came from the bowling alley. Not from the roller derby.
But let's talk about when we took the car up to San Francisco to go and see Levi and the Rockettes. Do you remember that? Remember when we stole the car?
I remember it vividly. I remember I was working at Licorice Pizza in the Valley, you know, because we're living at 909 West Hollywood. You know, right off of on Palm 909 Palm, right off of Santa Monica Boulevard. And sometimes I would take the bus sometimes to work, but often I would just, it would be easier to hitchhike over Laurel Canyon. So I would just do that a lot and wait for some cougars of the canyon to pick me up, or some, you know, a VW bus, you know, painted hippie van came by. You're like, all right, you know, this is a sure ride. And because there were still hippies around in the 70s, driving around over to Laurel Canyon. But anyway, I came back and I was always the worst grump after coming back from school.
Yeah.
Just the worst, you know. But who isn't? Who wants to go to work and come back and hitchhike back over the canyon? But and I came in and you and Anne and Dennis were sitting there, and you said, Dennis has stolen a car and we're going to go to San Francisco. And you can tell the backstory on that. But you said that, and I just looked like straight at you and I said, are you out of your mind? And I stormed into our room, because we were sharing a room, and I slammed the door behind me. And then probably not even 5 minutes later, I showed up back out in the living room with the overnight bag pack, saying like, when do we leave?
Yeah. I remember when you did that, we were crawling around with all the cushions off the couch, trying to find gas money.
Yes. And calling everyone we knew.
No one wanted to go with us, shockingly. But anyway, so Dennis had this Cadillac that he had. He didn't really steal it. He borrowed it from a guy he was doing a trick with at the Tropicana, which was kind of like the Chelsea Hotel. It was the LA equivalent. Like, everyone stayed there and lived there. Like, you know, at any given moment, like the Cramps would be there. Tom Waits lived in the back bungalows. Blondie would be there. I mean, the Split Ends, you name it. And so anyhow, what?
The Cramps were there.
Yeah, because this figures prominently into the story. Anyhow, so Dennis had this Cadillac, and I wanted to go and see my boyfriend, Levi Dexter, who later became my husband for a while. And that was why we decided to just take the car up to San Francisco. But first we had to go and Dennis had to shoplift a bunch of cold duck from the supermarket. I remember we had my panties over the license plate because we'd seen that in some like delinquent hot rod movie or something. So they couldn't read it. So, I mean, that's not a pull me over now. There's like a pair of lacy underpants. And so I had to go in as the decoy, and I bought like a jar of mustard or something. And then as soon as we were like on the freeway, everyone started drinking in the car, which is like, I mean, now I'm so horrified at that, but it was just a roaring party. Okay. We should just take another little musical break here, and then we will come back and continue this story because it's sick. All right, here we go. Little break. Anyhow, here we are back. So I remember we decided, we were all on speed too. So I remember we decided to stop at the Madonna Inn for something. And I'd never seen it before with all the puppets and dolls swinging from the ceiling. And we had some coffee or something, not that we needed it there. And then it was my turn to drive. And I remember like flying on 101. And I looked at the speedometer and it was like 100. It was like 100 or something. And I made a comment on that. And then I was like, wow, this is like Grand Theft Auto. Like it had only just crossed my mind.
The bird blood just drained out of all of us. You're like, oh, shit. We hadn't even considered that we were stealing a car.
at that point. And then we got into San Francisco, and because we bumped into this guy, Rico, who was the roadie for the Nuns. Do you remember that?
Yeah, great, good guy, yeah.
So he invited...
He did hair, too. He did everyone's hair.
Yeah.
He dyed everyone. He had sometimes blue hair with big orange polka dots in it.
Oh, yeah, and that's how he got SSI, I think, because he went in with his hair like that, remember?
Yeah.
Like, and they just immediately gave him supplementary social... they figured he was obviously insane if his hair looked like that. But so we went to his apartment and you guys were smoking weed and I didn't smoke it because everyone decided I was sober to drive the car to the club, like when we were going to go back, you know, into it. So I was driving the car and then the stolen Cadillac, and then I rear-ended, like, I think it was a BMW. I'm blocking it out, but I actually rear-ended it in our car. And these gang guys jumped out. Like, these were like, quote, unquote, adult men. Big, like Hispanic, Latinx gang guys. Mm-hmm. And then they immediately came up and they're like, where's your license and registration? And I just like was trying to be all casual, and I opened up the glove box and there was like nothing in there. And then all of a sudden I thought Grand Theft Auto again. And and they're like, what's your number? And I just gave them a fake number and it was the wrong amount of digits. And they're like, we're going to call the police. And then Dennis said, no, she's from a different country, that's her correct phone number. But we still didn't have, like, we just had the rental thing. And then Dennis said, well, I'm gonna call the police too. And he was so drunk, he was trying to put all the cold duck bottles in his jacket, but they kept like falling off and rolling into the gutter. he could hardly talk. So
I remember a really good detail of this. You gave them the you gave them your driver's license number. You just said, like, they said, well, you said, I don't have it with me. And then they said, well, what's the number? And you said, you know, 79DL76 or whatever. And they said, that's too many numbers. And you said, because that guy was from Australia. The car was rented to the guy, and you were saying, "It's my dad's car. He's gonna kill me," and blah blah blah. And then you said that, and they said, "That's not the numbers of a license." You said, "It is in Australia."
And Wiggly, I was crying because I thought, I'm 17 and I'm gonna go to jail for the rest of my life. Okay, but so then we got out of that pickle because the police never came. And in hindsight, I think that those people stole the car that they were into. I honestly think that. None of us should have been driving those kind of cars.
It was all too messy.
But so we went to the Deaf Club, which was really, it was called that. It was a punk rock club, but it was really a social club for deaf people. But we didn't know that, and we were trying to get drinks from the bartenders and no one was paying attention to us. And then we saw them talking in sign language. Uh-huh. But so then we announced to the rest of the, to the people when Levi's band was on stage, we told the whole club we stole a car, and if anyone wanted to come home with us and help drive, that we would, they could stay at our house. So do you remember the ride home?
A little bit. I think I slept the whole way. But then Javier come with us from the Zeros.
And then this girl, Johnny, that beautiful Johnny. Girl, Johnny.
African-American, yeah.
And then, we all passed out because we'd been on speed the entire time. And the second that someone that was supposed to be getting a ride with us started driving, we all just passed out.
And then we got home and we were like, uh-oh, now we're in trouble. And we said, what do we do with this car? So we thought, oh, we'll go ditch it. And then we thought, oh, you know, what we do? And then we call Anna's brother, our friend Anna.
Well, first we wiped it down with Windex and put it in the hills above the whiskey. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. That's what happened. And we thought, how we're going to get caught. So how do we avoid getting the electric chair? So we thought, let's call a lawyer, you know, and our friend Anna S, who was also with lobotomy, her brother was a lawyer, and or even just getting his...
He was in law school.
Yeah. And he said, what did he say? He said, like, oh, you know, it's too... he's not going to press charges. He said, you just need to tell him the truth is what's going to happen. And so we were like,
yeah, because Dennis was 17.
Yes, we're all underage. So it's in the deep. But because we got home and there was a note on the door at 909 saying from Jim or whatever his name. What was his
Charles.
Name?
His name was Charles.
Charles from Australia. He left a note saying, oh, I'm worried about you. And Brian from the Cramps gave us your address. I told him we were, because I think we had been talking to Brian when we met him.
They thought that Dennis was tricking with him, but they thought it would just be better, better monetary for situation for Dennis. Like that was why. But nobody from the Cramps knew that we stole that car or anything.
No, it was just like so. Brian Gregory dobbed us out, and then then we talked. We did. We threw ourselves at his mercy. And he thought it was hilarious.
he kept going, is the car okay? Is the car okay? And I was like, yeah, shut up. I was standing on the coffee table because we had taken a bunch of other speed. And so I was like, just let me finish. And so he heard the rest of the story. And as long as he knew the car was okay, then he called up the liquor store and ordered more liquor for us and asked if we could get any more drugs. And then we took him to the airport like in another day or two, and then he rented the car for us for another week, but we kept it for a month. Do you remember that? And then a year later he came into LA and he called me up, I mean of course on the landline, and he's like, this is Charles, I'm from Australia, do you want to go out to lunch with me? And I was like, sure. And when we started lunch, he said, I do believe you're the most intelligent and charming woman I've ever met. Oh. Hi, Charles, wherever the hell you are.
Yeah, Charles, thanks. You were a real, you were one of us. You are hilarious. I'm glad people could see the absurdity in our insanity.
Tell everyone about when we were living on the Bowery together with Christian from the Mumps and Bradley from Teenage Jesus and the Jerks.
Yeah, so we would make periodic. I had made periodic, both of us, visits to New York because, we, you know, with CBGBs and Max's and the New York scene, we were not going to be left out of that. No way. So didn't you have you had relatives on the East Coast already?
Yeah.
And I was, and I just, you know, I went once, I took a gray, I think both times I took a Greyhound there.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazed. Yeah, the first time I went with a group with Helen Keller and Rod Donahue and Mary Ratt, we all took a bus there the first time. And then I think the second time I just went by myself. And because you had already been there and you weren't you, luckily we had made friends with Christian Hoffman from the Mumps, you know, we and Bradley Field, his partner, boyfriend, who was in Teenage Jesus and the Jerks, who was quite the character, and the Peter Lorre of the No Wave, and exactly. And probably one of the more unsavory to many people, but a hilarious and wonderful character. And they invited us to come stay. They were just like, okay, yeah, come with us. I don't know if they expected us ever to show up, but we showed up. And they were glad to see us. And they are Christian is still a great friend. And we, so you were living there already for a while or staying there. I don't know, living, staying, what is it? And then I came as well. And then Christian lived at Bowery and Grand on the Bowery. And this is, mind you, the 70s when the Bowery was the Bowery, and, you know, and it was full of what we called then bums and, you know, alcohol drunks. And it was not, and, you know, it wasn't groovy at all, you know.
Taxis wouldn't even go down there.
Yeah, exactly. You know, some the brink of Chinatown. Yeah.
Yeah, it was right near Chinatown and Little Italy, and there was a subway stop. Do you remember one time we were coming home from Coney Island and we were on acid, and on the steps of the subway there was like a dead bum with an ice pick through his eye congealed, and it was like morning rush hour by the time we were getting home, and people were just walking over.
Yeah, we were like, oh man. And there was all we had our favorite bums who were in the neighborhood. There was Miss Bum, who was in a dress, a drag queen bum, and she would always stay warm by going on the manhole with the steam heat coming out of it, and cover herself in newspapers, and just talk nonstop the whole time. And I remember one time. We were up in the loft, which was probably, you know, four or five stories up, and you threw a bra out the window and it flew right down on the manhole where Miss Bum was. And Miss Bum, without even looking up or anything, just picked it up, put it on. I just went on with whatever she was doing, babbling on and on and on, like a gift from heaven, of course. And that's how Miss Bob was great. And then there was the feet.
Oh my God, you could tell when the feet was like even like approaching our block because the feet was
yeah,
feet.
Or sometimes he'd be in the doorway. He would have to crawl over. And the feet was this giant man, and he had horrible pussy feet and, you know, shoes without fronts on them, you know, with the fronts cut off, And you could just smell his feet from so far away. It was a little terrible. But somehow we loved the feet.
It was a gentle giant.
It was ours, our friend.
But, me and you used to, our daily or almost daily dinner routine would be walking up the Bowery panhandling so we could get enough to buy a cocktail at Max's Kansas City because you would get like the buffet there.
Yeah, the happy hour buffet. So you would go to Max's, go upstairs, and end up in the bar. They would have a buffet with great shrimp cocktail or whatever they have at buffets. But if you bought a drink, we'd like get one drink, and we'd all go eat there, and then the night would begin. You know,
and before you were in the Cramps or the Gun Club, We made a recording. You made a recording. I think it was your boombox. That again, we were on acid.
We were a lot on acid. A lot for a few years.
But me and Kid were sitting right in the front, and we were so fucking high. And he was like recording the Cramps whole set. But in between every song, what would we scream? We should do this. 1, 2, 3.
Is this that I'm having?
Yeah.
Okay. 1, 2, 3. I'm having a crazy nightmare.
This is in between every song, and apparently a bootleg exists of that. I've never had a copy of it.
Me neither. Where is that tape now?
God. Someone should send it to us. I know someone has it. P.O. Box 29504. Los Angeles, California, 00029. Please.
We will be indebted to you forever.
So what about like the, when you were still living at Disgraceland, when you joined the Cramps, we should take a music break and then we'll come back and talk about that.
Yeah.
Here we are back, and here's the story of Kid joining the Cramps and the first gig.
Now, I had started the Gun Club had started out of the ashes of a band called the Cyclones, which Pleasant was the singer of, and it was
Jeffrey made me do that. He forced me.
Jeffrey Lee Pierce, who got us all started on various things. He was a very Svengali-like person and a great mentor. But he made a band for Pleasant, and it was gonna be a rockabilly band. And it was called it the Cyclones. And I was the manager. I was artistic director. which I remember I was like gonna coach you on how to be the singer. And I said, well, if you get too nervous, just clench your fists and scream and fall on the floor. And that was my direction to you.
I just gonna interject for 1 second. I just remembered right now how I got a publishing deal for me and you writing a joke song. It was called Rockabilly Bondage.
Oh, yes.
All time on Saturday night.
Well, we need a record of that.
I
You need to record it.
We can do a duet on that together.
Exactly.
Okay, so go ahead. Tell
me. To publish it. And so out of that, then Jeffrey said, you guys played one or two gigs?
Yeah, just one.
Opening just the one.
For the
If you weren't there, you missed it. And playing with the Go-Go's, right?
Yeah, the Go-Go's and the Last.
At Gazzari's on the Strip. Wild, wild Gazzari's. And so after that, Jeffrey said, you should be in a band. We already had this idea, but I didn't know how to play. So I think, I was trying to learn to play when the Cyclones were going. And then, so the Gun Club, we became the Gun Club. And then, there wasn't really a lot of popularity or anything. It was just our friends would come see us. And actually all the other bands like X or the Blasters or people, they all saw that it was something good, but so that we were a band's band. And
It was great.
But then Lux and Ivy came to see us actually at the urging of Bradley and Christian, came to see the Gun Club because they knew, because Brian Gregory was leaving and they knew they were looking for a new person. And also Lux and I, we had moved to Los Angeles. And so just one day they called me up and said, do you want to be, or they came and met me and said, do you want to be in our band? And I said, well, yes. And they said, well, what would you sacrifice to be in our band? And I said, like what? Like would I quit the Gun Club or quit? I was going to LACC to quit school or relocate. Like, what do you mean? And Ivy said, no, like, would you cut off a finger? I said, I would actually. And she said, okay, you can be in our band. And that was it. I was in.
Luckily, your hair, wasn't it the first show you played at the Roxy where your hair caught on fire?
Yes.
Burning bush.
Exactly. Yeah, Lux, like, we had these, so I played with the Cramps and they have a song called Sunglasses After Dark, which a traditional theatrical song where, there's like a noise intro, a long intro, and all of the band turns with their back to the audience and puts on sunglasses and turns around. And we had these candles on our amplifiers and as lighting and atmosphere. And I had a huge Ronnie Spector teased out beehive and so much Aquanet extra super hold to keep it up that when I leaned over to the amp and I was making feedback and leaning over, grabbing my sunglasses, the flame just flew up and like whooshed over the outside of my giant bouffant, my Ronnie Spector beehive. And the audience just screamed and I was like, wow, great. And then suddenly Bradley was on the sides, came in and started throwing beer on my head. And then Nick Knock started hitting me on the head with his drumsticks. I was like, oh no, what did I do wrong? On my first gig with the Cramps, and I fucked up so badly, people are beating me up. And then suddenly I realized, oh, everyone was like, your hair is on fire. And I was like, oh, wow, I didn't feel it. Luckily, my hair was teased up so high, it didn't get near my scalp. Just outer perimeter went. And the whole place stunk like hair. And Lux Interior, the singer, did not miss a beat. He just said, the days of miracles have not passed. I present to you Kid Congo Powers, the Burning Bush. And my fate and my was legend ever since.
And then Michael, it was so legendary that Michael Jackson copied you in that Pepsi.
I know. Oh, God.
Oh, my goodness.
Powerful.
What else? Okay, let's wait. So you have a book coming out, and I have a book.
Yes. Let's talk about our books. I was going to say, you told me a bit about it before. But is it a specific time, or is it just specific subjects that you are?
Mine is specific subjects. Mine is called Rock and Roll Witch, and it's all the like witchy, paranormal, ghosty, synchronicity, supernatural stories. And you're in tons of them, but you called me up a while ago and you said, I just realized you're in like almost like every story in my book. And I was like, me too. You're in so many of the stars in my book, it's insane.
Yeah.
But tell everyone about your book.
Mine is the total memoir that goes from childhood to late 90s. And it's more of it's everything kind of memoir. It started out just outrageous stories, a bit like, you know, a bit of that. And then it started turning into like some serious stuff. And, you know, and I started, it was great. It was great writing about, because I started writing it and I said, I don't know what this book's going to be about. It's going to be my memoir, but I don't really know what the thrust of it is, but it will tell me at the end what it is. And I've been writing it for 12 years, just off, on and off. And every time, usually when I would get to the serious stuff, like traumas and this and that, I would be like, oh, I would jump out of my seat and go like, I have to make a new record and go on tour for a year. And then I'd come back to the book after that and I'd write a little bit more. And so it kind of went, so it was really good for productivity because I was just like jumping out of the seat all the time. But a lot of it is pretty hilarious, but it's very much like about what informed me to be me and just the singular mind I had since I was a kid, you know, to be involved in music and to see everything from an askew point of view and just misadventure after misadventure and a lot of adventure too. And it has the good, the bad and the ugly in it also. So, you know, and also the idea of growing up, you know, a suburban kid who at a young age knew I was queer, you know, and how that going through life and navigating rock and roll is been like a crazy ride. Like at times I'd be super flamboyant and out, and at other times I'd be super like standoffish and non-committal, and you know, it's all this crazy inner struggle, but mostly it's pretty hilarious. You know, that's a lot of stuff, but so it kind of runs. It's a super real memoir, and it's going to come out hopefully by next year or in the next year, and I'm doing it.
I can't wait. So it's coming out next year.
Yeah, so I hope, yeah, and it's going to be In the Red Records is putting it out, Larry Hardy at In the Red Records, and it's going to be his first publishing effort and also mine. So I've been with making records with him for 12 years or longer. So we're like a bit of a team, and so I'm excited to put it out with him, you know, because he's gonna treat it right, and he's given me a pretty carte blanche, you know, what to write, and let me pick my own editor and do all kinds of great things. So, and boy, am I glad it's done.
Yeah, I know. Like that was the same with mine too. I started when I was writing it, like, this one isn't a full linear memory, but the first story in mine was something super traumatic that happened to me at a graveyard, and I was writing it, and it was just, I was writing about riding through the graveyard with my brother when we were little, and the next day he died suddenly. I mean, so then I didn't write for a couple of weeks, but then when I was writing that story, I just realized, thank you.
I love
the whole book. dedicated to him. I know he was great.
He was great.
But
okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, but you were in it so much, the book, because of anything you guys that are listening, anything that we're talking about here, it does not even scratch the surface of this.
Yeah, I'm trying not to give anything away.
Yeah.
Way, there's way more where that came from. But yeah, no, it's lovely to be talking to you, because we have been, since the, mid to late 70s, mid 70s, we've been friendly in France, and and like I said, it's you're like a family member and part of a tribe of people, and I'm so glad. And you have also both of us have gone through many metamorphoses and kept our original vision of,
yeah, I know, it's crazy. Yeah.
And then mastered other arts and different things. And it's great. It's great. It's great to have friends like that. And I'm glad I do have friends like that. But you're probably the closest friend like that.
I know. Same here. Like, I feel like, now I wouldn't call you at 3 a.m. unless, I was calling from a spacecraft or something. But I still feel like I could if I wanted
to. I would answer.
Anyway.
There we go. Are you out of your mind?
Oh, yeah. Are you out of your mind?
And I'd be like, okay.
Where are we going? What's the holdup? Is there anything else that you want to talk about to our audience?
I think that we've kind of covered, the basics. And and it's just been a delight to talk to you, and I'm glad you're doing a podcast. I've been threatening to do one forever, but
you should totally do it.
Yeah. And did you do Lydia's?
No, Lydia's. I haven't done it yet. Did you?
Yeah, because I hope you don't mind, I gave her your number.
Oh, no, I don't mind, of course, but I remember in Lobotomy when you and I were in New York writing for writing more in Lobotomy, when we interviewed Lydia, remember she was in bed having sex with her boyfriend while we were doing the interview.
And on the tape, you're like, she's like, well, and then, teenage Jesus. And,
Oh my God. I know, nobody that is not our age could really, I'm not saying this like lording it over all you young motherfuckers. You can't imagine what it was like back then.
The freedom we had, yeah, to just be wild, it was a feral time.
It was exactly feral.
And we were adventurous, and we were happy to take the opportunity to experience it all, and to find other people that would be the same. I mean, when I think of like 909 and that we were just talking about, like Dennis Crosby and Lisa C. Bond and everyone, all these musician people and not musician people. And I mean, what a great, we were so nuts. How much fun. And then we would just rope neighbors into it, and everyone else, strangers, neighbors, would come.
But then everyone just said yes. It was like, we were like the Pied Piper of insanity.
Exactly. My God. Do you remember that time we took acid and we walked on Hollywood Boulevard, and then we were on our way home and someone threw a bucket of water on us?
Oh, yeah.
Or at us. I don't know if they threw it on us. But we were, and some like guys in a car just suddenly just threw a bucket of water at us.
The time when we were walking home on down the Bowery from CBGB's, also on acid, and on the way there we had seen that horrifying, messed up, like life-size baby doll sitting somewhere. And then and then it moved to a different point on the Bowery, and we saw it on the way home, remember?
Yeah, so we call it Baby Dibbles. After Dibs, somehow we were obsessed with everyone. Very crush word.
Tell everyone about like when we used to see Sid Vicious. This was right before the Nancy Spungen thing. When we were like, we'd always
Sid was in New York, and we were always on acid in New York and seeing going down the Bowery. But we'd see him at Max's or CB's or just walking around. And we'd be like, oh, he's beautiful, isn't he? Like, oh, and then the nasty sponge.
Tall thing. And pretty.
Tall and pretty for a murderer. And a murderer. But oh God, so much stuff. And it was just like always just another day in the light. I mean, that's when I was writing the book. I'm like, you could just pick any day and I could write a story about it and it would be something worth writing.
I know. So
it's almost like there were no boring days. They were all nuts. It really had to be an adventure every day.
Someone, this was like a long time ago, when this phrase first came into usage, someone said to me, this is what a peak experience is, something that changes your life, and it changes your your lookout and your whole viewpoint of life. And I just kind of went, oh, and I nodded and I said, I think I had a continuous peak experience for like at least 25 years.
Exactly. I'm still having it.
No, I'm having it too. I just didn't.
Right this minute. Oh, one more thing. Remember, because Bowery and Grand, actually one of the windows of Christian's loft. And thank you, Christian, for putting us up.
And for putting up with us too.
But one of the windows actually overlooked, you could. But one of the views was of the top of the World Trade Center.
Oh my God.
This one has to go. I don't think this is in my book, but we can talk. We'll give this one. And we were tripping again. And there's some good acid stories in my book. We were laying there just, having a relaxing, tripping time, looking at
It had already been light out for a pretty long time.
We just couldn't sleep. We had been tripping all night. It was the morning and very quiet. So, and then I was saying, oh, look at the World Trade Center. One is a girl, bopper, and one is this, rockabilly teddy boy, the other one, and girl has this beautiful jewelry on, and the guy has amazing quiff pompadour. I was saying she has beautiful jewelry and a nice dress, and you said that, and the boy one has a great pompadour and a quiff, and I just incredulously looked at you and said, real things don't have hair. That is a peak acid thing to
point. You're like horrified that I would even say that. You're like, what's wrong with you?
Thank you.
I just seriously almost peed.
That is that's our life. That's been
we should probably conclude almost, do you think?
Yes, yeah, so it's been a while.
Because otherwise it could go on for like hours.
Yeah, now you're on limited time. Your editor will have a nice time. Thank you, editor.
Thank you, Jerry.
Yeah.
Do you want to say anything last to our listeners?
Love you. Live fast, don't die.
That's good, yeah. Live fast, don't die. Yeah. I love you eternally now and forever. For everybody, that was the amazing, incredible, like, always pee in my pants funny for many, many years. And then I hope you guys had to wear Depends during this episode, or we're sorry you weren't. That was Kid Congo Powers. Let's blow everyone a kiss goodbye, is this outro. Like, mwah! Mwah. Okay, bye.
Bye, I love you, bye.
The Devil's Music is written and hosted by Pleasant Gaiman. Produced by Aaron Alden. All sound design by Jerry Danielson of Busy Signal Studios. And of course, is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at pantheonpodcasts.com. Our social presence is at Pantheon Podcasts on Facebook and Instagram. Tweet us at Pantheon Pods. All songs can be found wherever you get great music. Please pick up these important and fantastic tracks. It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.